First up this hour, our good friend in the United States, TJ O'Hara, strategic consultant, author, speaker, one-time independent candidate for the presidency over there. In one of the most amazing weeks, TJ, in your recent history, and you've had a lot of things going on in your recent history. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
What's happening with this speaker situation? Just explain to us again what the speaker is in your House of Representatives. It's different to our speaker. It's kind of like a prime minister over there, isn't it? The person in charge of the lower house.
It's absolutely closer to that than the way your speaker is handled. The speaker is also second in line for the presidency. Should anything happen to the president or the vice president, the speaker becomes president. So it's a critical role in our society. The challenge is we're playing games with it, as you well know. We've gone through 11 votes. If Kevin McCarthy was a baseball player and he was 0 for 11, he'd be in danger of being sent down to the minors. He has been doing, as we talked earlier in the week, a lot of backroom deals. He's yielded many of the demands of his Republican adversaries, including, interestingly enough, lowering the threshold to bring a motion to remove a speaker to just one lawmaker. Now, think of how vulnerable that makes the speaker position. And given the Democrats' impeachment of the weak approach to the last administration, this alarmed both parties with a weapon of political theater.
TJ, from this distance, it's a very weird situation because the Republicans didn't do nearly as well in the midterm elections as they thought. So they've got a majority in the House of Representatives, but not a big majority. But now This guy can't get a... McCarthy was expected to be the speaker, but now even amongst his own party, he can't get a big enough majority to become the speaker. How does that work?
Well, they're jockeying for positions. In the backroom deals, he's been discussing budget and appropriation changes that the minority wants among his party. He's given specific subcommittee chair positions to them. He's offered seats of the non-supporters, seats on some of the plum committees, including placing at least two on the House Rules Committee. They're asking for four, but he's offered two at this point. His challenge is there's still six or seven opponents who appear committed to derailing his attempt to become Speaker, and five is enough to block him.
So what happens in the end? I mean, can he keep holding on and they have vote after vote after vote, and he keeps losing, losing, losing? Or does he stand aside and they can find somebody else that everybody supports?
Either of those could happen. They're not anywhere near the longest ballot issue that we've ever had. Back in 1856, we had 133 votes taken over 2 months. And interestingly enough, a fellow by the name of Nathan Banks was elected as Speaker. He had been in one Congress as a Democrat, the next one as an American Party member, and the final one as a Republican. And there's a little humor in that because the American Party was nicknamed the Know-Nothing Party back in the day. Yeah. And I think that would qualify for both parties today.
Progress, such as it is. You know, I sometimes wonder about that. Matt, I've read a lot of U.S. history and I love it. It's a fascinating country. And it was built to be messy in a way, wasn't it? The founders didn't want everything flowing smoothly. They wanted these kind of stouches from time to time. But I also wonder, like the founders were around when there were 3 million Americans. There was no social media. There was no mass media. Now you've got 330 million Americans. You've got social media. You've got polarized media. You've got lots of this, lots of that. What would the founders make of America today?
I think the founders would understand. You and I have chatted in the past about free speech and free press, for example. And those are complex rights that were never meant to be easy. None of the Constitution was meant to be easy. It was an experiment that had never been tried before. It's the first time that the people were sovereign rather than a government. And that's a complex issue to address.
It is a complex one, and different countries adopt it or try to deal with it in different ways. Our free speech in Australia, for instance, people like to talk about free speech. Well, we don't have free speech. We've never had free speech. There are limitations. But the limitations here are greater than they are there. And I sometimes wonder, had your founders known what was going to evolve, whether they would have liked the way it's necessarily evolved, where everybody can virtually say anything. That is.
Well, I think they had a sense of humor, and they'd probably get a kick out of what's going on at this point. But honestly, misunderstanding of the First Amendment in this country, the First Amendment doesn't guarantee free speech. There are limitations here as well, probably not as many as there are in Australia, as you say. But the First Amendment begins, Congress shall make no law. And it goes on when you talk about speech and press. They'll make no law abridging the freedom of speech or the press. For the most part, individuals and organizations can do whatever they choose. You've seen professional athletes over here draw fire for kneeling during the national anthem, others for standing during the national anthem. However, they have that right. They can also be told by their team or the league what they're allowed to do or what they aren't allowed to do. They just can't be told by the government. And the real problem is that we're experiencing a blurred distinction within the context of the government, accomplishing an abridgment of free speech surreptitiously through its agencies and their influence on traditional and social media outlets, rather than doing it directly. And, you know, witness the revelations of Twitter and Facebook over here.
Well, that's been outrageous, where Twitter was absolutely controlling what was going on and what wasn't, and Facebook were doing the same.
Absolutely. And the government's not supposed to intervene surreptitiously any more than it is to pass a law. So I think that distinction has become frighteningly disturbed. I'll give you two examples.
Yeah.
There's a misinformation and disinformation movement on social media platforms suggesting that any position that disagrees with an ideological norm can be suppressed, and the government's beginning to exploit it. An example is the administration recently asked the media not to publish numbers related to border crossings. Well, our current run rate is about 3 million people per year, and if it was adjusted per capita for Australia, that's about 234 immigrants pouring over your borders without permission, which would double your national average annual growth. Yet our media outlets being told not to mention it. And correspondingly, my state just this week passed a law that puts doctors in danger of receiving a reprimand or even losing their medical license if they discuss COVID treatments with their patients privately in a way that's at odds with the CDC's position. That effectively reinforces what Dr. Fauci famously said over here, that attacks on me, quite frankly, are attacks on science.
Yeah, but that's crazy, too, isn't it? Because the CDC changed its position so many times, and so did Anthony Fauci.
Absolutely. He even stated that. He said, when you get more information, it's essential that you change your position. Well, that's kind of hard to do if your medical license has already been revoked. And from a historical perspective, because I know you appreciate it, it's funny to look back on George Washington. He died of throat infection. On the day of his death, he's subjected to four bloodlettings, an enema, an emetic to make him vomit, and the blistering of his throat, feet, and legs to restore the balance of his blood, because those treatments were the science of the day. Yet experts now can't even discuss a differing opinion.
Yeah, I thought it was... That was one of the worst things out of the pandemic. There was a lot of people have different views about it. When people say science is settled, I think you're no scientist.
True.
Yeah, yeah. I think that's a really powerful point you made. As was the previous point you made, did you say 3 million people have crossed the southern border this year or last year?
Yeah, we're averaging over 8,200 a day.
Yeah.
So it pencils out to about 3 million.
But TJ, you know, these are people who are coming across and you don't know their health status. Obviously, fentanyl and other drugs are pouring across. It's a really peculiar thing, particularly at a time when if any of our listeners want to go to the United States, you're going to stand for an hour getting tested upside down and inside out to make sure of your vaccination status and what you're carrying and what you're not carrying. It just seems crazy for a country to do that.
It absolutely is. It's putting people needlessly at risk, and it's all being done for political theater. It appeals to a particular element of the base that's very vocal, and it's being exploited for that reason.
Yeah. And one thing I wanted to bounce off you last week, we'd been touching on a little, and we've only got about 2 or 3 minutes left today. But I wanted to ask you the 2 or 3 biggest changes in your life that you've seen, whether that's technological or sociological, whatever that might be. So you reflect on 3 big changes around you in your life. What might they be?
Sure. I would say, personally, the PC revolution and the internet, when the internet became broadly accessible, because the first was life-changing relative to the impact of technology, and the second unleashed knowledge and communication opportunities upon the world that we had never seen before.
Yeah.
I'd default to the 2012 presidential campaign from a personal level. You know, I had the distinct pleasure of losing by 60 million votes.
And that's usually only 60 million. You got close.
oh, yeah, you know, that usually isn't what one might call resounding success, but my goal was never to win, but rather to create a more informed electorate. And I was able to do that with respect to those whom I was able to reach, and it gave me a platform to continue that effort by hosting my own show and appearing on shows like yours.
That's a hell of a
and
thing.
And I could say if I need three, if you press me for a three, yeah. I'd say in 2022. There's a release of a remarkable new book I've begun to read titled An Absence of Certainty. And life just can't get any better than that, Greg.
TJ's referring to my book. I'm glad it arrived safe and sound, and I hope you enjoy it. And maybe we can talk more about it when we talk again next week, yeah?
That sounds terrific. Thanks, Greg.
Love the chat, mate. Thank you. TJ O'Hara. And TJ's available online, and his work is always worth accessing.